Let's bow our heads for a word of prayer to open this day's session. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for a new day of life, of health, and of strength. We are grateful for the opportunity to gather, to share with fellow believers insights from the Bible, from history and psychology that bear on the important moral questions of the day. We wish your Spirit to be among us. We wish that all that is done and said will be done and said in the Spirit of Christ. Be with those who are not here. We especially think of Dr. Jones, who seems to be in the midst of losing his father. May your Spirit comfort him and his family. We pray these things this morning in Jesus' name. Amen. Our panel this morning is speaking to us. These first two sessions are going to focus on the public policy questions surrounding and relating to questions of gay rights, gay marriage, and religious autonomy and the religious freedom of the church. The first panel is tending to focus more on the question of religious liberty and religious autonomy of the church in response to anti-discrimination laws. That really is a sort of separate question from the issue of the public policy question of gay marriage and whether the church should affirmatively engage in society on one side or the other of that question. You can perhaps see how those are related, but distinct questions. In our second panel, we'll deal with that second question. There is, within the Christian community, I think I mentioned last night, this conference comes from a biblically faithful perspective, and as I wrote in my letter, as understood by two millennia of the Christian church and the vast majority of Seventh-day Adventists. It's not that there aren't other readings of the Bible that we are aware of, revisionist readings. Those readings, however, have been explored at length in another conference and book that was done about a year ago. And I'm going to share that book with you, Christianity and Homosexuality, some Seventh-day Adventist perspectives. And there was a conference, 16 or 17 articles, all but one or two setting out the revisionist perspectives, saying that the Bible shouldn't be understood as Christians have understood it for 2,000 years. I want to acknowledge those arguments, their existence, and suggest that you should read them and read this book. We have responses to these arguments. We wish to have a dialogue. We just don't want to have a contentious debate. These arguments have been set forth. We are doing our best to intelligently and carefully respond to those as part of an ongoing dialogue. However, even those who have a biblically faithful view of what the Bible teaches on this topic aren't entirely in agreement on questions of public policy, on whether or not the church should support or oppose or say nothing about issues of gay marriage. And that will be reflected not so much in this first panel, but the second panel will have one major presenter as well as the lunch panels who set out the case for the church not being involved or not opposing or even supporting gay marriage. And it is a question in which there is a diversity of views presented, and you can listen, read your Bible, and come to your own conclusions on it. However, this first panel, let me introduce its members. The topic, gay marriage, religious liberty, and the church. Barry Bussey, who is the chair of this panel to my right, is the Religious Liberty Director for the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists. He's actually Associate Director in the office, and his portfolio is to represent the church to the U.S. Congress on Capitol Hill. And to my left is Gerald Shapur, who is an attorney in Canada, many years of experience practicing in the area of employment law, health law, and other corporate issues. But he has something of a specialty in representing religious institutions, defending their autonomy, their ability to make religious choices. And he has been involved in litigation involving claims by gay activists and homosexuals brought against either the church itself or against pastors who have spoken publicly on issues of homosexuality. To his left is Alan Reinach, the the Pacific Union Conference Religious Liberty Director, good friend and fellow comrade in arms in the legal world. He has spoken and written on issues of Proposition 8, gay marriage, and how the church should respond. To his left is Bill Knott. Elder Dr. Bill Knott is also elder, and he is the editor of the Adventist Review. He is not only the editor there, but in his spare time, I don't know how he managed to pull this off, also got a PhD in American religious history from a major university in the Washington, D.C. area, and he's here to share his thoughts as well. So, Barry, let me let you take the podium and lead this panel.
Morning, everyone. What I propose to do this morning is just, just outline a general framework from a law and religion perspective. And then I'm also going to share with you a wee bit of my involvement on this issue in Canada. Law and religion meet at the crossroads of human conscience. For millennia, the dissonance of divided loyalties has impacted both. In fact, if you were to look at Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons, we find an intriguing exchange between the main character, Sir Thomas More, and Cardinal Wolsey. The Cardinal devised a plan whereby he wanted to have More enable King Henry VIII to get a divorce. More refused to be involved because of conscience. And an infuriated Wolsey states in the play, "You are a constant regret to me, Thomas. If you could just see facts flat on without that horrible moral squint, with just a little common sense, you could have been a great statesman." To which in the play, More replied, "Like you, my lord." Wolsey's disdain is but one example of the lawmaker's sentiment down through the centuries when faced with that rare breed with the fortitude to manifest unbending conscience at odds with the majority opinion, or the orthodoxy. To the politician who makes compromise an art, that horrible moral squint is evidence of a traitor. And when that rare breed arose in the context of the church, they were seen as nothing less than a heretic. Now, More's contemporary, of whom More really had no time for, Martin Luther, also took a position against the church. And in 1521, Luther, when summoned before the Diet of Worms, was ordered to recant, and his reply echoes to this day, "Unless I am refuted and convicted by the testimonies of the Scripture, or by clear argument, since I believe neither the Pope nor councils alone, it being evident that they have often erred and contradicted each other, I am conquered by the Holy Scriptures quoted by me, and my conscience is bound in the Word of God. I cannot and will not recant anything, since it is unsafe and dangerous to do anything against the conscience. And here I stand. I cannot do any other. God help me." The modern age has produced its own stalwarts. Martin Luther King Jr., for example, spoke of conscience when he said, "On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? And vanity comes along and asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right?" And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular. But he must do it because conscience tells one that it is right. When the church has to deal with such a very controversial and contentious issue, perhaps one of the most trying issues, certainly of my lifetime, has been the issue of gay marriage. It is difficult because the church has become aware of the pain that individuals who are going through their own identity crisis, the struggle which many of our members are going through, many of our family members and our friends. And so we have the struggle with this reality. Society has gradually, at least in the Western world, has come to the view that homosexuality is not a sin or a deviance any longer. It is, in fact, a normal lifestyle that must not only be accepted and condoned, but celebrated. And part of the process of celebrating the lifestyle is that the gay community is seeking to remove any ability of the religious community to have any say in the public sphere about the morality of same-sex marriage. The most commonly used argument is that religious beliefs have no place in public policy discussions. Bruce McDougall, who is a law professor, and you'll have to forgive me that I make references to Canadian sources, because that has been where the bulk of my experience has been. Bruce McDougall, a law professor and a homosexual activist at the University of British Columbia, notes that the traditional conservative religion is, quote, the major voice that would deny any celebration of homosexuality by the state. The characterization of the cases for equality rights as being about religious freedom, he says, is a justification for translating religious standards and views into political and legal decisions about equality issues such as sexual orientation. Robert Wintermute, a professor at the University of London in England, notes that there should be a quid pro quo. Allow religious exemptions to the gay community allow religious exemptions to the gay, lesbian, gay, LGBT equality in the religious private sphere, and in turn, the gay community will respect freedom of religion by not asking the law to intervene to change the internal doctrines of religions as to who may be a religious leader, who may enter a religious marriage, end quote. Yet, he also says, and I quote this, as a result of the courageous efforts of the LGBT and the heterosexual individuals working from within to change internal doctrines, I believe that religious institutions will realize one by one that they have been wrong all these years about discrimination based on sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, and will voluntarily change their internal doctrines. They were wrong with regard to the persecution of the Jews, their forced conversion of indigenous peoples, and their support for slavery and apartheid. And they have acknowledged and learned from these mistakes. As sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity, discrimination in religious institutions wither away, the need for an exemption for the religious private sphere will disappear. Although it is unlikely to occur in my lifetime, I look forward to the day when, for example, the first lesbian pope issues her apology for the sins of the Roman Catholic Church against the LGBT persons around the world, end quote. So obviously, by the courageous efforts of those within the religious community, such need for an exemption, the idea that we would have an exemption for the religious community with respect to hiring practices, for example, will no longer be necessary. President Obama held a reception at the White House on June 29 for leaders of the gay community. As you may know, he has been under a lot of pressure from the gay community for not moving fast enough on their agenda since taking office. At the reception, he reiterated his support and his plans to support their cause, and then he noted, and I quote, "Now, even as we take these steps, we must recognize that real progress depends not only on the laws we change, but, as I said before, on the hearts we open. For if we're honest with ourselves, we'll acknowledge that there are good and decent people in this country who don't yet fully embrace their gay brothers and sisters. Not yet. That's why I've spoken about these issues, not just in front of you, but in front of unlikely audiences, in front of African American church members, in front of other audiences that have traditionally resisted these changes. And that's what I'll continue to do so. That's how we'll shift attitudes. That's how we'll honor the legacy of leaders like Frank and many others who have refused to accept anything less than full and equal citizenship. This same view of the idea of changing the religious attitudes was dealt with in a case in the Supreme Court of Canada involving a religious school, Trinity Western University, out in the province of British Columbia, and I'm sure Mr. Chipier here will make reference to it in his remarks. But what is interesting is the opinion of the dissent, and what happened in that case was the university required the students who were part of the education program to sign a document that said that they would not be involved in any extramarital affairs and so forth, and of which they listed a number of items, not only just your traditional honesty and all the rest, but also dealing with acts of homosexuality and so forth. During the review process by the College of Teachers, the British Columbia College of Teachers refused to grant Trinity University a degree-granting status because of the requirement that students had to sign this document. Now, as it turned out, ultimately the court ruled in favor of the school and allowed the university to receive its accreditation because it found that there was no evidence of discrimination, because part of the argument was that these teachers, when they leave the school, would discriminate against gay students in the public school system. But there was no evidence of such. However, in the dissent by a very influential judge, LaRue Dubay, who incidentally is no longer on the court, but nevertheless her views even though throughout her career she's often been in dissent, her views have ultimately caused the court in a number of instances to revisit its earlier decisions and actually go in what once was her dissent. And so that's why I pay so much attention to her dissent. And in this dissent, she says, "I am dismayed at the various points in the history of this case, that the argument has been made that one can separate the condemnation of the sexual sin of homosexual behavior from intolerance of those with homosexual or bisexual orientations. This position alleges that one can love the sinner but condemn the sin. But in the words of the intervener Egal, requiring someone not to act in accordance with their identity is harmful and cruel. It destroys the human spirit. Pressure to change their behavior and deny their sexual identity has proved tremendously damaging to young persons seeking to come to terms with their sexual orientation. The status or conduct or identity practice distinction for homosexuals and bisexuals should be soundly rejected." And she quotes a lower court judge who said, "Human rights law states that certain practices cannot be separated from identity, such that condemnation of the practice is the condemnation of the person." And she added that the kind of tolerance that is required is not so impoverished as to include a general acceptance of all people, but condemnation of the traits of certain people. This is not to suggest that engaging in homosexual behavior automatically defines a person as homosexual or bisexual, but rather is meant to challenge the idea that it is possible to condemn a practice so central to the identity of a protected and vulnerable minority without thereby discriminating against its members and affronting their human dignity and personhood." End of quote. My point in all of this is this, that what we are seeing throughout society is we're seeing a change. And the question, and I'm going to cut my comments short here because time is of the essence, as they would say. But what we are seeing here is a great movement in the attitudes of society at large, certainly the attitudes of the courts, as is evidenced in Canada, and increasingly so down here in the U.S. When we argued before the Supreme Court of Canada dealing with the issue of marriage, the church did not get involved in the political campaign about the government's redefinition. What we did, though, was that we stated our view before parliamentary committees. that the church stood for the traditional definition of marriage. I argued the case before the Supreme Court of Canada. The need for religious protection, should it agree the government had jurisdiction to redefine the institution of marriage, which they did. And our concerns were these. Our ministers being forced to marry against their conscience, our church facilities being used to perform ceremonies against the church's teaching, our church schools being forced to teach curriculum not in keeping with our faith, and so on. The court agreed with providing protection on the first two, but refused to deal with the schools issue that we raised and said it would be on a case-by-case basis. Well, why would we even raise the issue of schools when you're dealing with marriage? Well, because if you would read the law journals, the same individuals, such as Professor Bruce McDougall and so forth, you would find that it is only the next step in the process. McDougall, for example, says, in the context of an accredited school or college, however, the state is lending or transferring its authority and duties to such institutions. The constitutional obligations of the state ought to be transferred with that authority and duty. So there's no question that as the logic continues, even though a private school does not receive government funding for its operations, it nevertheless receives government authority to issue diplomas. And in other words, those religious institutions that do not accept gay rights and celebrate the gay community within the school curriculum ought not to be accredited. And already we see in the province of Ontario where heterosexism, the curriculum has been vetted to ensure there's no heterosexism. We've got the province of British Columbia that instituted a gay-friendly courses, not yet required, but certainly has it available. So McDougall then also goes on and states, and I'm just going to have to cut my comments off because I want to be fair to my other panelists, but he states, religious ideology cannot be used to determine what people who are not of that religion can do or how they should lead their lives. And this is certainly something that we would be agreeable to. However, his position, though, continues on because he says this, in my opinion, it should not even be used to judge those who are of that religious persuasion. So even children, and again this is a quote, even children being raised in a particular religious tradition should not be exposed to ideology that excludes and refuses to accommodate homosexuality in their education. The state has an interest in all education of the young, and this ideal should prevail. So it is on this basis, as you read the journals, and as McDougall has been quoted by the Supreme Court, we can see that the issues of religious freedom are intermeshed. And so that is part of our struggle as we look at this issue. I want to pass the time off right away to my colleague and friend, Jerry Chipier, who has represented the church in numerous cases before the Supreme Court of Canada. And so, Jerry, I turn the time to you.
This lectern reminds me of the lectern that you stand in front of in the Supreme Court of Canada. It's a very friendly scenario, but there is a time limit. And I remember in the first case that I represented the church on, I had 10 minutes. And when that final minute ticked off, the red light went on. And halfway through my final sentence, because I had timed it just right, the Chief Justice at the time, Dixon, interrupted me and said, I see that your red light is on. And that was it. The time was over. So I will be very respectful of your time as we begin this discussion this morning. The other thing that I will do from the court is that I won't read to you the article that you have in your binder. You can find it under about, I think, halfway through the second set of materials. And I chose a title for this discussion that is somewhat unrelated to what I'm going to talk to you about, simply to put my discussion with you in context. I title it, The State Should Stay Out of the Bedrooms of the Nation, and then I also put an asterisk there, and so should the church. I'm very much a libertarian. I come from a country that is very different than the United States. In fact, some people would say that I'm just maybe an inch this side of an anarchist. I don't see a lot of value in government because I continue to fight it. But half my practice is representing government, so you know I can't say it's totally without any value. It does create work for lawyers. But it's important as well to keep in context the political differences between the United States and Canada as we go through some of these cases. The Canadian Conservative Party, the governing party today, Prime Minister Harper, starts out on the ideological spectrum to the left of President Obama. So you have Republican, Democrat, Canadian Conservative, Canadian Liberal, Canadian Socialist. So, and I can take you through every issue from climate change to health care. In Canada, we don't have a private option. You're discussing down here whether you'll have a public option. We don't have that debate at all. We talk about it being entirely public and no room for a private option. If you want to talk about Afghanistan, if you want to talk about Iraq, if you want to talk about any political issue, abortion, there are no laws at any level, federal or provincial, the only country in the world, on the subject of abortion in Canada. So you do not have any debate in Canada on abortion, stem cell research. It's fully funded and legal. There is no debate on any of the issues that you would be debating when you go into the ballot box. So just so you understand, Canadian Conservative, that means the government today in Canada, starts to the left and then goes further to the left. I just tell you that for context. And I would welcome any challenges, but I can guarantee you that between President Obama and our Prime Minister Harper, Mr. Harper will be to the left of President Obama on every issue, including gay marriage. And gay marriage is not only the law in Canada, it is beyond debate in Canada. It is a part of the social fabric, and it will not change. There is no political party that advances that. There is a political party that has no members in the parliament or any legislature that advances it, but other parties that have members within the federal parliament or a provincial legislature, there is no party that is even discussing this issue, the abortion issue, any social, what you would describe as a social conservative issue, not up for debate. In that context, then, and we can talk about how that happened, but that's not the purpose of my talk today. I know Professor Gagnon asked me last night, how did you get there? How did this happen? And I'd be happy to talk about that on another occasion. But today, I'm here to talk to you about the consequences of a society that Canada is for church members and the church, because that's my experience. I got involved in this case not because I've ever studied the issue, not because I've ever been involved politically in the issue. I just happened to be probably the only lawyer crazy enough to get involved. I guess I'm a contrarian. You know, if the majority is going this way, you're going to find me going that way. So as a contrarian, I was very happy to take on a case and cases that you might consider to be politically incorrect. And I'm going to go through some of those cases as we review this morning, remembering that I've got this little red light to worry about. At the beginning of my paper, I highlight one important fact that we need to keep in mind as we go forward. The Canadian experience started, the change started with a prime minister by the name of Trudeau. Back in the 70s, he advanced the proposition as justice minister that the state does not belong in the bedrooms of the nation. And you know what? If that model had stopped there with that statement, we wouldn't be here today, or I wouldn't be here today, because there would never have been a case to go to court on this. Because if the state truly did not interest itself in the issue of sexuality, then there would be no debate about this, because church members and churches would be free to interact as they chose within their own perspective on both law, life, and social issues. The problem comes because once the state got out of the bedroom, and once that issue was left alone, it then came back. A few years ago, the issue of gay marriage became the issue to be debated in Parliament. And as Parliament debated what was going on in the bedrooms of the nation, the issue became not whether the state is going to stay out of the bedrooms of the nation, but whether or not you as an individual and whether you as a church or a business, whether you are going to say, no matter what happens in the bedrooms of the nation, I support that. Not just I tolerate, I allow, I respect, but I actually agree that what you're doing is a good thing. That's the debate in Canada today. And that's why the church and members of the church in Canada are facing problems, because they are being asked to say, regardless of my own moral choices, I affirm your moral choice, and I am going to tell you that I believe that you are doing what is right, both in my eyes and in the eyes of God or society. That's the debate. And let me just take you through some of the cases so that you can put that statement, because that's the issue, in context. The first case that I got involved with was a case involving Delwyn Vrend. He was a teacher at a university just north of Canadian University College called King's University College. It was a Christian Reformed college, and the church took the right position. The Christian Reformed Church took the right position. They did not ask Delwyn Vrend what he was doing in his bedroom. That was not their concern, properly so. But they did say to him, you must, as a teacher, support the position of the church that hired you. He decided that he couldn't live with that restriction, and he became an activist on campus. And the president had to sit down with him and say, we can't employ you as a teacher because you're teaching a lifestyle that is contrary to the teachings of your employer. I remember when this case was in the middle of the courts, when Mr. Vrend challenged that decision, and in the Human Rights Commission, and the Human Rights Commission refused his request to investigate and find a problem, because they said sexual orientation is not in the Alberta law. And I remember the Mormon Minister of Education at the time was sitting with the president of King's University College, and the president apologized to the Minister of Education, saying, I'm sorry that we've created all this controversy for you. And it was interesting, the Minister of Education said to him, I would have been disappointed had you not stood by your principles. You are a Christian university. If you didn't, then what is your reason for existence? You may as well just get out of the business if you're not going to be taking a position on these kinds of issues. At the end of the day, the Vrend decision just came to this conclusion. And it was based upon an interaction. I don't know if you were there, Barry, but at the end of the case, the Chief Justice said to me, I believe that this law intends to protect all human rights, and if it intends to protect all human rights and doesn't include one right, then it is discriminating through that exclusion, and that is that. And that was the conclusion. They didn't say that the government had to protect human rights. In fact, the government didn't have to pass a human rights code. But if it chose to, and then it said in its preamble that it was going to protect all human rights, that it had to do what it was saying in the preamble. That's the consequence of that decision. Many people, of course, have interpreted that case as saying there's a constitutional right to protection from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. But in fact, the case did not say that. It just simply said, if you say you're going to do something, you have to do it. You can't say you're going to protect all human rights and then leave one out. The next case you've already heard about, and that is the Trinity Western University case. The next issue was not just simply, does the state have to protect individuals on the basis of their sexual orientation? And by the way, there was no argument from the church with respect to whether or not the state should or should not protect individuals from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. But the church did say If there is that kind of law, there should be the ability of the church institution, the college, to claim a bona fide occupational requirement with respect to teachers in a Christian school. And, interestingly enough, the Supreme Court of Canada went out of its way to agree with that and say, yes, of course, if you have a school that is a Catholic school or a Seventh-day Adventist school, and that school does not support sexual relationships outside of marriage, then certainly if someone does do that, they can be fired and they cannot make a claim against that church on the basis of that decision. The next issue was in Trinity Western. In Trinity Western University case was very important because in that case, the accreditation body, in this case the BC College of Teachers, used the Human Rights Code of British Columbia to try to say to the college, we can't give you an accreditation because of the requirement in the code that all must, including you, must treat individuals with equality, with non-discrimination. And you are graduating teachers who will and are trained to discriminate. And in fact, the argument of the dissenting judge went like this. Your moral code says you cannot have sex outside of marriage. You do not, Canadian society at the time does not allow marriage. Therefore, you are necessarily saying that there can be no homosexual relationships. And therefore, if you believe that and sign on to that as a teacher, you will necessarily discriminate against the children from homes of same-sex parents. So that was the argument, and therefore we cannot graduate you as teachers because we are going to be graduating bigots. The consequences of a loss in that case would have been that not only would teachers have been impacted, but I guarantee you that lawyers... 3 minutes, thank you. I guarantee you that those individuals who are in other professions would have been mixed up. And I can tell you lawyers and judges would not have been excluded, and I can tell you that because right now the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal has before it a reference from the government of Saskatchewan where marriage commissioners, and effectively individuals like judges who marry individuals, are being told you cannot work as marriage commissioners unless you perform same-sex marriages. And this is notwithstanding that the marriage reference that's referred to in the paper specifically said that if you, for religious reasons, choose not to perform a marriage, then the government cannot force you to do that. Even with that explicit statement in that decision, you still have the Human Rights Commission and the Justice Ministry in Saskatchewan prosecuting marriage commissioners and effectively attempting to take away their jobs if they choose to not marry individuals on the basis of sexual orientation. I can't, because I only have 2 minutes left, I can't go into detail with respect to some of the other cases that you'll see in the paper, so I'll get to the end, the closing two cases that are most important for, I think, you to keep in mind as you make decisions and as you consider this topic. The first is the case of the Hutterian Brethren. In this case, and Mitch Tyner and I were involved in a case many years ago where we, on behalf of a Seventh-day Adventist, convinced the Supreme Court of Canada to provide a reasonable accommodation for Adventists who could not work during the Sabbath hours in a public school system. A very important decision. Very important interpretation of what an accommodation means. Unfortunately, the court has changed since that day, and in this case, Hutterites, who are like the Amish, do not choose to have a photograph on their driver's license. For 30 years, the government of Alberta accommodated a few hundred Hutterites in Alberta and gave them driver's licenses without a picture. But after 9/11 and the hysteria over the whole issue of security, there was this concern, well, we're going to have identity theft. Can you imagine someone pretending to be a Hutterite to commit fraud? I mean, it's laughable. But that was the government's position. We have to cancel these few hundred licenses so that we can protect the public from identity theft, from people stealing the identities of Hutterites. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision said, yes, the government can do that. It can quit accommodating after 30 years of accommodation. The scary part of that decision is that the court simply said, you know what, too bad for you, you're an outlier, you change. You go out and hire somebody to drive you around. You move closer to the city so you can walk. But the government does not have to change, and furthermore, they can change the rules along the way. Unfortunately, as many of you lawyers know, it's often biases of judges that lead to bad decisions. And unfortunately, the Chief Justice, who switched her vote in terms of principle, grew up in southern Alberta. And unfortunately, farmers in southern Alberta don't like Hutterites. Why? Because they collect a whole bunch of land and drive up the value of the land and make it more difficult for farmers to make a living. So southern Alberta farmers, and she's the daughter of one, hate Hutterites. And I'm absolutely convinced that we lost that case because of her childhood and nothing more. Now, I wouldn't say that to her, but I'm convinced of that. And my time is up. I commend the paper to you. I would suggest one thing. With the attitude of our courts, and I suspect many of your courts, after hearing from your California Chief Justice, the courts are going to take a very hostile view to religious organizations that choose to not comply with the politically correct position that is advanced within society, and that there will be consequences for both individuals as well as institutions as you go forward if the definition of marriage is changed.
A few years ago, I was the token plaintiff's lawyer at an American Bar Association meeting in Florida, and it began at 8:30 in the morning. And I said, so this is how you treat plaintiff's lawyers. You make us get up at 5:30 California time and do a presentation. Somehow I thought maybe my good friend and colleague Nick Miller might treat me better, but here I am having a rose at my alarm went off at 4 o'clock this morning, California time, and with the vagaries of travel, I left my home at 4 o'clock yesterday morning, and I still was unable to get here in time, thanks to weather, Chicago traffic, etc., last night. But I'm glad I had the papers, and I hope that you guys will pay attention to what is in print. You have to realize that in 12 or 15 minutes, I can't give you chapter and verse on what's contained in 20 pages with 53 footnotes. What I can do is give you the executive summary, and my subtitle is Time to Wake Up and Smell the Equality. You know, when I was in law school in North Carolina, they told me that the United States was on a tilt and everything loose rolled into California, otherwise known as the land of fruits and nuts. Well, that may be true. There may be a kernel of truth in that. But the fact is, as goes California, very often so goes the nation. And so what I want to do is give you a little perspective, the view from the front line, so to speak, in this conflict dealing with gay marriage and same-sex marriage and religious liberty. Now, the first thing that struck me sitting here in a university setting is that this is not an academic issue. This is not simply food for intellectual thought for us to ponder, because students, your ability to be licensed in the career of your choice, many of which today require licenses, whether you're going to be a doctor, a pharmacist, a lawyer, a teacher, a social worker, your ability to be licensed in your field will depend upon the outcome of this issue. The very ability for this denomination to continue to operate universities, and even more of a threat at this point, is the threat to our elementary and secondary schools because of movements dealing with accreditation. And by the way, there is case law in the United States that accrediting bodies are not state actors. They are private entities and are not required to abide by the Constitution. So if accrediting bodies decide that the standards for accreditation require compliance with politically correct values involving gay rights and same-sex marriage, you may not have any legal challenge, any constitutional challenge to raise, because it is not necessarily a state actor. It is impossible to overstate the risks. And folks, you need to understand that we're way beyond live and let live. Barry, our chair here, did a chapter on this very topic in the book we published about a year or so ago called Politics and Prophecy, and examining the heated rhetoric and positions on both sides of the culture war and whether there was any prospects for a so-called truce. Adventists, we are not by nature partisans in the culture wars. This is not really our battle. We don't have any fight against gays in our community. Our only fight is to proclaim the gospel and to prepare the world for the coming of Christ. Okay? However, our ability to operate institutions, and I've already at least mentioned, our ability to function as individuals in harmony with our biblical beliefs. We are the ones who are being forced to consider what sort of reaction, what sort of action to take because of the threat to our own rights. We're way beyond live and let live. I think Barry or Jerry raised the question, well, how do we get from here to there? And what the California Supreme Court has enlightened us about is that the way we get there is incrementally. You're well aware that last year the Supreme Court decided cases involving same-sex marriage and decided to extend to the right of same-sex couples to marry to protect it as a fundamental right under the California Constitution. The way they got there was by reviewing not the history of marriage, not the definition of marriage. They gave not even a column inch, not even a sentence to the history of marriage or an understanding of marriage. What they did was review the history of legislation and the extension of rights to gays. It happens incrementally. So when we look at bills in Congress that we would find unobjectionable on their face, bills to say that gays should not be discriminated against in employment, for example, we say we don't see any problem with that on its face, but you have to understand that incrementally is how we get to the point where the rights of same-sex marriage are treated as a fundamental right. And the court has said this in two cases in California. The second case to come down involved some physicians in San Diego County who had religious objections to providing certain types of family planning services to an unmarried lesbian. And at the status that the case was at, we really don't know the facts. We don't know if their views were because they were unmarried or because they were lesbian. It went up to the Supreme Court at a very preliminary stage of the case. And the court pitted very directly the rights of the doctors, their conscience rights, as against the rights of the patient. And the irony here is that the patient was referred to another clinic. She did obtain services in a timely manner, and there was no harm to the patient. But despite the fact that there was no harm to the patient, the court ruled that the statutory right of the patient not to be discriminated against based on her sexual orientation trumps the conscience rights or the religious freedom rights of the doctors. Now understand where we have come to in California. Number one, Barry, I think, used the term heterosexism without explaining it. Any one of us who believes that sexuality morally is expressed in a heterosexual relationship, we are heterosexist. And in the eyes of California law, heterosexism is equated with racism because both sexual orientation and race are protected by the same legal standard. They are protected as fundamental rights. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has not extended protection to sexual orientation as a fundamental right. Not yet. Will it? Well, we don't know. If the pendulum keeps swinging in the direction it's going, then that would be the natural result sooner or later. So in California, number one, sexual orientation has been equated with race. It's a fundamental right. And number two, if you have a situation where you have a conflict of rights, you have a gay right on the one hand and you have a religious freedom right on the other, you cannot expect that there will be a balancing of these rights. What you have to expect is that the gay right will trump the religious freedom or the right of conscience. It is an unlevel playing field. Now, I say that for a couple of reasons. Number one, the California Supreme Court, despite a long history of protecting religious freedom as a fundamental right, in the last 15 years has waffled. And it is now publicly, formally, officially confused and does not know whether free exercise is a fundamental right under California law. So for all practical purposes, religious freedom is no longer protected as a fundamental right in California, but sexual orientation is. So you can see right there you have an unlevel playing field. But there's a more, perhaps, if that's a theoretical thing, there's something more practical. We had two cases last year. The first one, the marriage cases, pitted Proposition 22, a ballot initiative establishing marriage as a man and a woman as a matter of state statute. And the court said we have this statute on the one hand defining marriage as a man and a woman, and on the other hand, we have what we have called a fundamental right. Dealing with sexual orientation, the right to marry. So the court said logically, as we pit these two against each other, the fundamental right will trump the statute. There's a logic to that. But then in the next case, the sexual orientation was protected by statute as against the right of religious liberty, which historically has been a fundamental right. It's certainly a constitutionally protected right. And in that case, the court said the statutory right trumps the constitutional right. So I come to the conclusion that in all the kinds of conflicts that we have seen already around the country, we've tried to gather many of the most significant ones in our paper to give you a picture of the kinds of conflicts that we're going to face in the future and what the risks are both for institutions and for individuals. Thanks to my lovely efficient computer battery, my computer shuts down just when I need it. Now, why do I use the subtitle Wake Up and Smell the Equality? Well, I got it from a blog from someone who favors same-sex marriage and gay rights. Well, I'm going to close. It's so critical that we understand what the competing set of values are. We come from a biblical worldview, and sometimes it's difficult to grasp what the logic is of those who see things differently. For starters, The logic is that equality trumps liberty. That equality is the primary value, not liberty. Now, I use the term heterosexism. There's another term that the legal scholars use. They talk about intimate discrimination. And I think of Jerry's quoting from Trudeau that, you know, keep the government out of our bedrooms. The legal scholars have given a lot of thought to this very point. And yes, they say that sexual expression, sexual identity, even gender identity, these are issues that the state should stay out of, and they're quite explicit about what the implications of that are in terms of not only recognition, but full social and legal equality for people regardless of the numbers of intimate unions. In other words, polygamy is going mainstream. When I say polygamy is going mainstream, a very distinguished law professor from Georgetown, Kai Feldblum, was just nominated to serve on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, civil rights, and charged with enforcing American civil rights laws. I deal with the EEOC constantly in dealing with our Sabbath discrimination cases. This is a very significant posting for someone who has signed a manifesto in support of the full measure of sexual freedom and legal recognition for multiple marriage, you know, for polygamous marriages, for pretty much the state to recognize any form of sexual expression and to stop trying to impose morality on our intimate choices. And so the term intimate discrimination is now being used by the scholars. So, do I have a crystal ball? Do I know? Is the pendulum going to swing in the direction that California is going? No, I don't. But we as a church, certainly, if we care about our schools, if we care about our young people and students not having to be forced to make a choice, and I will tell you as an attorney and a minister, we lose an awful lot of our young people who go into the practice of law because the secularizing pressures of the profession are such our young people are very often choosing their professions and their careers at the expense as the church gets crowded out. And these kinds of pressures are only likely to increase and become more acute as a problem. Thank you.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.